Amy McDonald. Amy is an environmental health educator for the University of North Carolina Center for Environmental Health and Sustainability, Community Outreach and Engagement Corps. Amy provides consultation and technical assistance to local health departments, the public, community-based organizations, and professional groups. She coordinates the North Carolina Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Program and serves as the lead staff implementing CDC's lead and pregnancy guidelines. Amy holds an MS degree in environmental policy and behavior from the University of Michigan. Please help me welcome Amy.
Good morning. I hope you've all had enough Halloween candy from the exhibitors next door. And I also want to say thank you for being here this morning. As a Michigan native, I'm glad you're here, not out celebrating the Giants win. All right, so today I'm going to talk about implementing some guidelines that were published in November of 2010 by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Group on Lead Poisoning Prevention. I came to this work as serving as a contractor between UNC Chapel Hill and the Division of Public Health, and I'd like to thank my colleagues Maria Valentin Welch and Dr. Barbara Hackley for helping me understand the maternal health world and also the literature on this topic. So the lead poisoning prevention program in North Carolina has seen great success since its inception in 1995. Someone asked the question in an earlier session about impacts of public health cuts in the lead world, and I really think what funding does is put boots on the ground, and this is certainly what happened with our program in funding local health departments with that CDC funding. But during this time, we knew there was a really key and susceptible population of pregnant women who our program did not serve. We had no federal guidance about how to assess exposure during what we knew was the earliest stage in a child's life, being in utero. So we knew there were several factors that were important, including mom's stored level of lead, which could be mobilized during pregnancy, her current exposure from her housing or her occupation, and then the housing that she brings her baby home to and what she might be exposed to while she's breastfeeding. But as I mentioned, without guidance, we just sort of did this in our state as a case-by-case basis. So if in doing an investigation of a lead-poisoned child, we found out there were other children or a pregnant woman there, we might do a blood draw. But otherwise, there was no systematic outreach to this population. So today I'll cover four main areas. One, talk about risk factors of lead exposure during pregnancy. Discuss the CDC guidelines, describe our implementation experience, and of course the lessons we've learned. So how many folks here have sort of a clinical background? Can I see a show of hands? Okay. How about environmental health? Okay. So where's everybody else kind of fit in? Okay. Okay, great. So I'm not going to go into deep discussion about health effects of lead. We're told this is the oldest issue, so everybody should know, although we've learned differently in implementing these guidelines. But at high levels, lead can lead to colic, motor clumsiness, weakness, paralysis, and in extreme cases, death. Fortunately, we've not had a child death from lead poisoning in several years in the U.S., but it can also cause hypertension and kidney damage, impair cognitive function, lead to behavioral problems such as ADHD, and then it impacts male and female fertility. In terms of pregnancy, high exposures of lead or even low exposures of lead can lead to gestational hypertension, miscarriages at levels even as low as 5 to 9 micrograms per deciliter, lower birth rates, and then declines in intelligence. Now, the 2008 NHANES data cited that almost 1% of all pregnant women have a lead level of 5 micrograms per deciliter or greater. And we know that across various exposure levels, there are very serious effects of lead on the fetus. So some of the risk factors during pregnancy We know the main one is immigration status. And some of the key countries we found women might be coming from with high lead levels include Mexico, Ecuador, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and India. So for us, this gets especially at some of our refugee populations. And in North Carolina, we are starting to see more Pakistani refugees in particular. Pica, or the eating of non-food items, can be a risk factor, as well as use of alternative remedies or cosmetics. We found several cases where a mom might be feeding her child or even taking during her pregnancy bits of pottery because it's understood in her culture that that's where you can get some key minerals. We've also seen problems with clay, particularly in African countries, where the clay traditionally holds a lot of microbial value. However, it's been contaminated with lead, so now women are rapidly uptaking lead from those home remedies, as we call them. Other things, exposures on the job. And in North Carolina, we have several battery manufacturing plants where women work. And then, of course, exposure from housing, especially housing with lead-based paint, likely in North Carolina, that's housing from the 1950s, although anything before 1978 may contain lead-based paint. And then finally, nutritional status and lifetime exposures. So women who are well-nourished, particularly in calcium and vitamin C, have a less likelihood of uptaking lead compared to women who don't have those suitable amounts of those nutrients in their bodies. So here's a look at the CDC guidelines. The full title is up there. And what they tell us, they finally published in 2010 after several, I guess about a year and a half delay, but there's no such thing as a recommendation for universal testing. What they recommend is all pregnant women be given a screening for lead exposure, and that's to be done via a verbal or written questionnaire. Cases are managed by the medical provider according to the blood lead level results. If the risk questionnaire is administered and a yes answer occurs, then a blood test should be performed. And then finally, and unfortunately, no surveillance data is captured by CDC about this population. So here's a summary of the action levels. This is all measured in micrograms per deciliter. At a level less than 5, if a draw is done, again, after that questionnaire, no follow-up is needed, but the woman should receive some lead education. If it's greater or equal to 5, she should be more formally assessed for that exposure, and I'll describe that momentarily, and also receive a nutrition referral, and in our state, that goes to our WIC program. At levels of 10 or greater, she should be removed from her occupation if it contains lead. This is a major item here, and this is why we're told the delay of the guidelines happened, because this sort of de facto changes OSHA law, where a woman would not see medical removal until a level of 50 micrograms per deciliter. At a 15, an environmental assessment of the home should occur, and that's where our program comes in. We'd use the same protocols as we would with a child-led case. At a level of 40 or greater, she's advised to pump her breast milk and discard it. Some people have expressed a lot of concern that that level's very high, but the ACLIP made the judgment that the benefits of breastfeeding are there until that level of 40. And then finally, at a level of 45, she's deemed a high-risk patient and should be transferred to a place where she can have a medical provider who's specially trained in lead poisoning case management. So we have these guidelines in hand. We're excited. We've wanted them for a long time to address this population, and we had some key steps to our implementation, which has occurred over the last 2 years. We formed a work group. We developed and piloted tools for clinicians and health educators. We were able to incorporate the assessment into the local health department agreement addendums. Then we were able to disseminate our clinical resources and also do some occupational health outreach. And then finally, the point where we are today is training. So I'll describe each of these. Our work group was made up of environmental health folks, maternal health folks, occupational health people, local health departments, the WIC program, and the State Laboratory of Public Health. You know, when you put a group of people together, you immediately find everything that isn't going to work. And the first thing we determined was that our state lab did not have capacity to handle samples for any pregnant women that needed to have their blood tested. So unfortunately, this differed from the protocol of child-led, and the samples had to go out to the private labs. Our main charge was develop and implement our plan, and then come back in a year and evaluate it. See how we did, if anything has changed in the landscape, and if there is any kind of data we can look at, what does it look like? So here's our tool of the risk questionnaire. The main things we're looking to assess is if she's ever had a history of a high lead level, including during her own childhood, if she spent time outside of the U.S., and there's a list of countries that are of concern that we've provided, if she's using any of those home remedies, things like Mexican pottery or Mexican candy that's known to contain lead, and then if there's been any major renovations in her home, particularly if it was built before 1978. And then if others in the household have a job or hobby related to the lead industry, and then based on any water tests she may have had. So this is something we piloted in an urban and rural county in North Carolina. Unfortunately, we didn't go through any kind of formal study to be able to draw blood. It was strictly something to get ease of use and how does the questionnaire work. We also developed this educational brochure in English and Spanish and are able to provide that to clinics. And also, this is what our adult-led program is now sending out to any women who come through their database for having a lead exposure in their occupation. So our major, I think, tool in getting these guidelines on the ground was utilizing the maternal health agreement addendums. And these are contracts that the health department signed with the state health program to provide services in order to receive those state funds. In 2010 and 11, when these came out, our program was basically trying to stay below the radar in terms of our state legislature. Because we were so afraid we might take a cut because we'd already received several. And the child-led rules and statutes have been administered through the North Carolina General Assembly. So for child-led, if you want to do something, you need to go to the legislature. In the maternal health world, we were able to make some progress by just working through the contract process. So what's required in the agreement addendas is that the medical providers assess for lead exposure and also provide education. And I will say, unfortunately, with using these agreement addendas as our main tool for implementation is set, we are missing the private sector medical providers. And that's just, at this point, very unfortunate. We're still conducting outreach to them, but as our first mode of implementation, we are serving the health departments and hoping that we will get at a large group of the most susceptible women who are being exposed to lead. So some of the opportunities we've seen in implementing these guidelines is first really linking the environmental and maternal health programs. At the time of implementation, the environmental health, children's environmental health program was in a whole different department from maternal health. And some of that legislative shakeup that happened, which is why we were just trying to lay low, that moved us back into Division of Public Health, which ultimately is probably a good thing, but at the time caused a lot of challenges. But yet, linking our two programs, we've learned a lot from each other, and I think will serve us well in particular being able to address additional toxins in the future as we learn more and more about other maternal exposures to environmental contaminants. We've also have an opportunity to educate parents and women of childbearing age at a very early point about lead. And then we're also able to address, if there is a lead exposure, address that first thing, rather than waiting until the child is 1 year old when we would catch them in our child lead program with a blood test. And then finally, the agreement addendas were just a real key tool for us in terms of opportunities. So then, of course, the challenges. And man, there are so many more challenges than opportunities. They kind of came in three stages for us. The first was the delay of the guidelines from CDC. So I understand there are various reasons why that happened. But for us, you know, we had built a lot of partners and allies who then retired or were had their position eliminated. So that sort of stalled things for us. And then, as I mentioned, our childhood-led home agency was reorganized with several key positions cut, including our clinical nurse position. You know, at the main center of all this is a lack of data, and it's very hard to make that sell to your administrators about why you need this program when you don't even know how big the problem is or how many samples the lab has to analyze or how much it will all cost. And then, of course, the state lab not being able to handle those samples, and then just the differences in environmental health versus maternal health. As we rolled out, the next phase was limited guidance from CDC in terms of implementation. Kind of felt like they were sort of published, and then what actually was happening is CDC's lead program was battling just to remain in existence, and they did take a 94% budget cut to the childhood-led program, so I can understand they might have had some more pressing things on their plates. But also they had no funding for implementing the guidelines or even maintaining surveillance of the results. We also found that there was a lack of knowledge about lead, especially among medical providers, and that Title V funds were very limited for the uninsured. So those funds have to be used for ultrasounds or injections to prevent preterm labor or an interpreter or bus tickets to get mom to the clinic. So it's, you know, very hard to make these decisions about how to spend those limited funds. And then finally, we had this challenge that haunted us and still does today about who is the lead agency. Is it maternal health or is it environmental health? Environmental health knows lead, but maternal health are the people who understand women and pregnancy. And basically, we decided that we were going to bypass that question and just go ahead and work away. And it's totally possible not to have a lead if you have committed staff to seeing things implemented. So finally, lessons learned. Look to agreement addendums as a possible policy implementation option, especially when you're working on issues that affect folks who may be served only by local health departments. Getting buy-in from piloting your materials is very important when you need very busy maternal health clinics to do this questionnaire for you. You know, getting that buy-in is key. Surveillance data, it's better than Halloween candy. It's really important to have and track. No funding sends the wrong signal. So with no funding from CDC, these things kind of could have just died for us, but we really tried to not let that happen. We continually need to raise awareness, even though lead is an old issue, about health effects among maternal health providers. And then finally, the lead agency is helpful, but not necessary. So the last question, should other states do this? These are only guidelines, they're not required. I would say yes, because a lot of these challenges may not apply to your agency, but some do certainly remain that you should be aware of, the main one being no data or tracking mechanisms. So if you have a way to track that surveillance data in your state, please do and tell us what you found. And then just know that there's sort of limited guidance from CDC. There's still that lack of knowledge out there among providers, and we still have this problem of uninsured women needing services that there just aren't enough funds for. Okay, thank you very much.
Are there any questions for Amy?
Environment anymore, and that it's not a real concern of all the different.
Microphone.
used to walking when I give my presentations. So the main gap of education and providers is one, they just don't see it as something that's still out there today. And the other is this belief that a little lead is okay, you don't need to worry about it. Because as you know over time, or you may know, we've consistently dropped the levels of exposure for lead in which we take public health action. And now we say there are no safe levels of lead that you could be exposed to. But potentially when that provider was in practice, that level may have been something like 50 micrograms per deciliter was okay. Mm-hmm. So that's a great question, and maybe the main critique of the guidelines is that there's not clear guidance about, we say the woman should be removed at a 10, but when does she go back to work? Because in the OSHA worker guidelines, it's very clear. So no, my understanding is that what exists is just these guidelines from CDC, and as far as I know, there's still been no formal OSHA change. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so sources of lead for refugees. One thing that's important to know is many of them may have spent their whole life in a refugee camp, so they're in that category of very low nutritional status where they're very susceptible to lead. They may have been exposed to batteries as an energy source and had a lead exposure there. So then they come to the U.S. and their bodies are basically looking for vitamins and minerals, and if they're put into housing that has lead-based paint in it, that's maybe very affordable, they can very rapidly uptake that lead. But then there's other things like Greta and Azarcon, which are just some home remedies that you take for stomach ache. Other things might be makeup or powders used in religious ceremonies. So there's kind of a wide range, and there's a very comprehensive list by country and source that's included in the guidelines.
I think we'll have to wrap it up there, but please help me thank Amy and all the presenters for a great session.